Hey everyone, and welcome to another episode of Upzoned, where every week we take just one big story from the week in the news and we upzone it. We talk about it in depth. I'm Kia, and I am here with Chuck, who I just got off of a two-hour webcast with. How are you doing, Chuck? I feel like I just asked you this question.
Yeah, no kidding. I'm really hungry right now. Because so. I had a two-hour meeting this morning and then went right into our thing. And then, yeah, so I'm going to go eat when we're done.
Okay, sounds good. Well, I fueled up with a little bit of peanut butter and I am ready to talk about an article that I just found that I was like, I need to know what Chuck thinks about this. And it's from the New York Times and it's called I'm an Engineer, but I'm Not Buying into Smart Cities. It's from Dr. Shoshana Sachs, whose name I'm probably mispronouncing. She is an engineer and professor out of the University of Toronto. And in it, Dr. Sachs is making the argument for something I think we've talked about in a couple of different ways at Strong Pounds, which is going back to the dumb city, forgetting all of those bells and whistles like smart sidewalks and trash cans with sensors on them and solar powered like panels in our roads, and just refocusing on the nuts and bolts of good governance and keeping the potholes filled and things of that nature. I thought it was a really compelling article, not least because I was like, how do we get to the point where this is an article that needs to be written? So I wanted to talk to an engineer in my life because a lot of my experience with engineers, frankly, is talking to Strong Towns advocates. Chuck, what was your reaction to this piece? And what do you think it says about your profession that this article is making the rounds?
The last part of your question is really interesting because I'm 46 years old now, so I'm not quite young and I'm not quite old. I haven't really reached like curmudgeon age yet, but this soothed all of those like latent, like emergent curmudgeon instincts in me. And the funny thing is that I think engineers as a general profession tend to be a little curmudgeonly. Let me give a good reason for that. I don't think it's a disposition as much as it is a reaction to reality. I remember when I was a very young engineer, the kind of cool new thing were these wastewater treatment things called constructed wetlands. What you would basically do is go out and instead of treating your sewage in a traditional wastewater plant, which is like a mechanical, you know, thing that is built, or treating them in rural areas in a big pond where you let the sewage sit for 6 months and then it kind of is naturally treated and then it gets drained out at the end of that. Those are two like 1,000-year-old time-tested methods. I mean, like literally, like this is how people have been doing it for a long, long, long time. Instead of that, we would build these wetlands and we would have the sewage flow through there and they were lined in certain ways and they had certain little things done to them and certain plantings. The people doing it were young and they were hip and they were cool and they were like cutting edge in the engineering profession. So, you know, in general society, they'd still be outcasts, but amongst engineers, they were cool. And I remember being like enthralled by this, like, oh my gosh, we could build these things. They look nice. They fit in with the neighborhood. They're more flexible. All the engineers that I worked with were like, no, we're never doing this. And like, why? Why? And they're like, because it has to work. If we're going to spend $2 million, $5 million, $10 million, $20 million building a wastewater treatment system, and I'm going to sign off on that as an engineer, and you as a community are going to make a one in every 50-year or 80-year investment in this thing, it has to work. It cannot be something we experiment on. It has to work. And what that requirement does is it hugely favors the most proven of proven technologies. You can't do the constructed wetland for a big city because it's not proven. Like, what if it doesn't work? What if when it gets too cold, it stops working? What if the next year the vegetation doesn't grow back quite right? What if, what if, what if? And in a sense, it's unfair to new technologies coming in, but the engineering profession is, we always like to joke, it's the second oldest profession. It's been around a long, long time. And basically it operates under the guise of what worked before will continue to work. Take whatever you did and double the size of it, and you might start to feel comfortable about it. There's a hyper-conservative nature to it. So I'm not surprised to see the engineering profession or engineering professionals push back on smart cities, because the things they're doing in smart cities are, and my reflex always has been, oh my God, that's so dumb. I think that the critique, the substantive critique from the engineering profession is one that we probably should listen to on this.
Obviously, some engineers are buying into this smart city idea because this writer is writing from Toronto, where Google's Sidewalk Labs project has launched, and it's probably the most famous smart city initiative in the world. I have had conversations with folks at even Strongtown's events who are like, what if, hold up, instead of narrowing the street, we put in like a sensor that like can sense when like a pedestrian is coming, and it'll, blah, blah, you know, and it's like, what? Like, I always get so frustrated by those conversations because I am a Strongtown's advocate. I'm someone who I want to get like the quickest, most like cheapest, most common sense, reversible solution in the ground, see how it works and iterate from there. When do you think the engineering profession started buying into this tech craze, you know, and like, what do you think it's going to take to sort of get us off of it if we are going to get off of it?
I don't know as the engineers buy into it wholesale. And I think what you're seeing is probably the ones who, like me as a young person, were like, either this is really exciting, or the other kind is like, there's a market niche here that I can get paid to do that other people aren't doing. So there's a, you know, a deal there. I want to draw an analogy. And I actually think this is an analogy hinted at by, you know, Dr. Sachs in this article. If you think of like the early Alexander Graham Bell telephone system, do you think that this was a reliable system? No. You know, did it function real well? No. Could you get the things you needed when you, no, it was not reliable. It was like a kind of a niche thing. And then, you know, you grew to have party lines and you grew to have like different ways of communicating. It basically, telephones went from this iteration of the very early days being not very reliable and not very helpful to being ubiquitous. And now today, if you have a landline, it is, you know, maybe considered like old technology, but it's incredibly reliable. You know, the call is going to get through, whether it's in a village in Nairobi or whether it's, the call is going to make it because it's like proven old technology. Think of your cell phone now. How often does your cell phone go out? Does it not work? Is the connection bad? Do you dial and you get hung up on? It's like all the time this happens. And this is technology that's been with us now for 25, 30 years. The idea that we come up with a new idea and all of a sudden it should be everywhere, like it's good, it's proven, that may work because we can tolerate cell phones that go out and we can tolerate data interruptions in our download stream. And, you know, we're looking at a YouTube video and like it doesn't play, so we got to go to a better location. We can tolerate that because those things don't matter all that much. Picking up your garbage, having your sewage go away, making sure that like the pipes work, having the street, you know, be operable. These are things that have to work. There's not a world in which we can accept 95% runtime. And I think that's one of the things that engineers struggle with, because the scale at which we're doing things and the pace of change at which we do them is not really compatible with what is ultimately a very conservative kind of profession, which says we're going to do what we absolutely know works because you're absolutely counting on it to work. She talks in this article here about, you know, would we accept the same rate of disruption in our water and power systems? I think the answer to that is no. This technology is great, and I'm glad that City Labs wants to run this, you know, guinea pig experiment on a bunch of people. I think much like Walt Disney's version for Epcot Center in the original days, it's a place to try something out and develop technology and see what it work if it works. But like, I wouldn't want, you know, Brainerd, Minnesota, or New York City, or wherever to say, City Labs is doing it, so let's do this everywhere.
I think you mean Sidewalk Labs, just before Richard, Florida.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's fine.
Sidewalk Labs. I'm interpolating other things today because I'm hungry.
It's an interesting tension, though, because I'm sure that some people are listening to this and being like, hold up, like I thought Strongtown's told me that incremental development is all about testing out new strategies to make our city stronger all the time, taking risks and incrementally getting a little bit better. Our colleague Daniel, this morning, we're recording this on Wednesday, July 17th, wrote a really great article that sort of addressed the people in our audience who are afraid that we are demanding too much change out of our cities. We get the opposite critique, trust me, all the time. Is there a balance to be struck between the kind of techie experiments that, when employed in a sort of rapid prototyping way, could make our cities stronger, and the sort of like ultra conservative, like the water has to come out of the pipes, the electricity has to come out of the wires, the bridges can't collapse kind of infrastructure that you're describing, Chuck? Is there room for tech in what we do in our infrastructure realm?
I think there's two answers to that. The first one is that you alluded to this earlier. Why are we trying to do these difficult things or these new cutting edge innovative things when we're really failing at the very simple things that we could easily do that we know would have a huge positive impact on people's lives and the way our cities function and our overall prosperity? It seems a little crazy to me to be talking about automated vehicles and how they're going to create this revolution, and we need to pour like our heart and soul and passion into making this happen, when like literally walking across the street, which is an easy thing to do, is impossible in many, many places. I don't understand that. I'm also going to quote from Dr. Sachs in this article. She writes, "There will always be a place for new technology in our urban infrastructure, but we may find that often," and she says, in quotes, "dumb cities will do better than smart ones." I think that too. I mean, I think that there is a ton of wisdom in the kind of standard set of things that were handed down to us by thousands of years of human trial and error on how to build cities, that if we just went back and tried to do more of those, we would find an immense amount of benefits. I interviewed Ann Sussman for the Strong Towns podcast that will come out next week. I think it'll be the next one after this one runs. She wrote, was one of the authors of the book, Cognitive Architecture. And she makes the case that traditional cities, and let's just call them human habitat, you know, the evolved human habitat that co-evolved with us through the centuries, is really evolved to tap into some basic, almost like primordial things in our spinal cortex that help us function day to day. One of them that we talked about is buildings that mimic faces, you know, buildings that have geometries that are comforting to us. We don't build in this way anymore. We threw that out, like it's long gone. But if you go back to traditional cities, what you see is that the streetscape actually reflected forms that were comforting to us as human beings. Where's the place for that in a smart city? You know, where's the place? She actually makes a case, and I think is very brilliant, that companies like Apple and companies like, you know, GM and automakers, they study very intensely human emotional reactions to things, how we respond to different designs, how they make us feel, the range of emotions, positive and negative, that they give us. And they will design their automobiles or their iPhones to tap into those kind of primordial things that when someone's smiling at you, your disposition is better. When a device is friendlier in interacting with you, you feel better about it. These are things that these companies have figured out. By focusing on sensors and how quickly we're going to pick up the garbage and you know, can our AV vehicle transport, we're focusing on all these metrics that really have nothing to do with humans and the way humans operate in these places. And I think until the technology slows down and does that, it, you know, instead of trying to come up with the question that our technology solution answers, we actually focus on the humans in the human habitat and respond to their needs. We're going to create a lot of things that may have some bling, but aren't really going to make anyone's lives any better.
I think that's a beautiful way to put it. And I think that we should change our name to Dumb Towns officially. I'm going to put in a petition for that. You know, consider that my big contribution this week. Let's go on to the down zone. Chuck, I am curious to hear a little bit about what you've been reading, watching, listening to, enjoying in these hot summer days.
I think I mentioned last week that I was in this book, Theft of a Decade, and I listened to it and finished it all in my travels last week. So the Theft of a Decade, How the Baby Boomers Stole the Millennials' Economic Future. If you're a baby boomer, you should listen to this too. It's not inflammatory and it's not accusatory. Like it doesn't try to make a case that will, you know, create generational warfare. It just says like, look, here's why we did this policy. And that may make some sense from one perspective, but here's a different way of looking at this policy from a different generational perspective. And here's the damage it does. And I feel like those conversations are not happening today and they're critically important. And this book lays them out very nicely.
Very cool. Well, there we got a little barking dog on my end. I was going to say, excuse me, Zozo. I've been reading a lot about the breed Alaskan Malamute because I found out that's half of what my dog is. Last week at my breed reveal party, my all black dog is half Alaskan Malamute.
Wow. I love Malamutes.
Yeah, he's such a sweet boy. But the one thing I would enter into the down zone would be actually something I know that you have already enjoyed and seen, Chuck, which is the movie Yesterday. You posted about it on Facebook, and I got away from these raucous little animals who really desperately want to play with the cats right now and snuck away to see it. It is a very sweet movie, specifically about a Indian British man who wakes up after an accident to find that he now lives in a world where the Beatles never existed, and he's the only person who can remember their music. And so, of course, he does what any aspiring singer-songwriter would do, and he records their entire catalog and passes it off as his own. And, you know, like that premise is just so sweet. And as someone who grew up listening to the Beatles, I was willing to forego any little qualms I had with the science fictional universe premise of this and just kind of bask in the music and the like silly little references to, you know, maybe Harry Potter also wouldn't exist if like the Beatles had been subtracted from our worldview. So Yesterday would be my recommendation today.
It was such a beautiful movie. And I have such a deep emotional connection to the Beatles. I know a lot of people do. I'm not saying anything unique. I knew every Beatles song. That's what I grew up on. Like literally, I think before I could walk, I could probably dance to all the Beatles music. We listened to every single one. And it was such an important part of every important moment of my life, like has a Beatles song attached to it. So when I went to this, I think the powerful thing to me was watching, you know, the actors, obviously, but the characters in the story react to a Beatles song for the first time. And, you know, they hear The Long and Winding Road or they hear Yesterday. You're just like, oh my gosh, you know, because you see the stunned look on their face and like, you know, wow, that was so beautiful. And you're like, yes, that's the beauty that my life has had for 46 years has been that beauty. And to kind of step back and recognize it again and be able to appreciate it more deeply. I bawled through that whole movie. Like I literally, like I was there by myself and I was so thankful because I was just like a mess. Can we do one spoiler?
Yeah.
Okay. So if you want to see this movie, we're going to talk for 30 seconds. I want you to stop this podcast right now because I don't want to ruin this for you. And this was the most beautiful part of the movie to me, but I've wanted to talk to you about it specifically. What was the most touching part of the movie for you? Did you have like one moment?
That's a hard one. I'm going to have to think that through. I really like the storyline with his girlfriend. Okay. So yeah, you tell me, what was yours?
When he got out of the car at the ocean and met the guy in the house.
Oh God. Yeah. I was like, I can't believe they're doing this. Yeah. I don't know. We can really spoil it if people want. It's crazy.
Maybe we can just leave it at that. It was overwhelming. I'm like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. And they picked the perfect actor to play this person who we will not name. Yes.
And it just, it allowed me to, you know, think about someone. It allowed me to think about someone that's been gone for a long time, you know?
Yeah. 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 He was really important. Well, you guys really got to see this movie now to see why Chuck and I are getting emotional.
I love that part. It just was like, oh my gosh, this was, stolen from us. And just to watch it again, it's like, wow.
All right. Well, this is an unexpectedly cheery end of Upzoned. Chuck, my animals are still making noise, so I
go walk
you to take the outro for me today. I would really appreciate it.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for hanging out with us and letting us get a little emotional here. And enjoy the rest of your day and keep doing what you can do to build strong towns. Take care, everybody.